From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Lesser artists borrow, great artists steal, Stravinsky supposedly said. But where's the line? Last week, Marvin Gaye's family won a big case and nearly $7.4 million when a Los Angeles jury found that Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams stole from his work, broke copyright with their song Blurred Lines. That decision, if it stands, could have big implications for the sound of the music you hear. This hour on Point, copywriting the creative, and what's ahead for the music industry. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you think the jury got it right? Isn't borrowing just part of making music? How much is too much? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK with Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up behind us right there. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Joanna Demers, forensic musicologist. What a great title. Chair of musicology at the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music. Author of the book Steal This Music, How Intellectual Property Law Affects Musical Creativity. Joanna Demers, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio is John Kellogg, entertainment lawyer for over 30 years, assistant chair of the Music Business Management Department at the Berklee College of Music, author of the book Take Care of Your Music Business. John Kellogg, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here, Tom.
All right. Let's listen to what some of the players had to say here. Here's Nona Gaye, daughter of Marvin Gaye, talking after the verdict about her feelings on the lawsuit, Blurred Lines versus Got to Give It Up.
He's been gone for 30 years. So when this happened, there was nothing else to do but stand up for him, stand up for his music, stand up when someone was going to try to pilfer and take something away. And when it's not right, it's not right, period.
Stand up for him, says Marvin Gaye's daughter. Of course, she and more, $7.4 million richer after that verdict, or hoping to be. Howard E. King, attorney for Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke, told Fox Business last week that Blurred Lines is not copied from Marvin Gaye.
We owe it to songwriters around the world to make sure this verdict doesn't stand. My clients know that they wrote the song Blurred Lines from their hearts and souls, and no other source.
Well, here's Gaye's lawyer, Richard Bush, talking with Fox Business about the verdict. Said Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke took more than just the vibe of Marvin Gaye's song, Got to Give It Up.
What they did was they spelled it out for the jury. They broke it down compositionally, and they showed that it was not the taking of an era, that it was not the taking of a genre, as Mr. Williams wanted to say. It was the taking of a composition and all those elements. The constellation of those elements did it.
Joanna Demers in Los Angeles, what do you see here? There's a lot of very high eyebrows after this verdict, and people talking about the lines, speaking of blurred lines, lines being blurred or moved here around what can be copyrighted. Why is there so much consternation about this verdict, Joanna?
Well, this verdict, again, if it stands, if it's not appealed or overturned, is representing a sea change in terms of how copyright law has been interpreted. The devil in the details is that the copyright law as it's written is extremely vague on what elements in a music composition deserve protection. The way that the law has been interpreted in courts for the past century until this verdict last week has privileged only two elements as being deserving of protection, and those two elements have been the melody and the lyrics, if there are lyrics, to a composition. What this verdict suggests is that property status is now going to be conferred on other elements of a composition, things like rhythm, things like a bass line, and just even more ephemeral things, things like timbre, instrumentation. So we're talking about just an enhancement of all of the elements that we consider to be protectable, and that is just going against more than 100 years of practice.
John Kellogg, how do you see it? Your job, I guess, very often is to defend the interests or advise on the interests of musicians. So do you see an offense against copyright as we've understood it here, or do you just hear What, the celebration of a vibe. Marvin Gaye had a vibe, and Pharrell and Robin Thicke, or mainly Pharrell, we see in the records that have come out here, came in and you know, continue the vibe. Did they break the law?
Well, I agree with Joanna. Over the past 100 years, basically the melody and the lyrics have been the things that's really been protected. I think the interesting thing in this case is that the Marvin Gaye, and particularly Motown Records and their publishing company, mm-hmm. Joe Bett, deposited the sheet music to the song instead of the recording. They could have deposited the recording.
When you say deposited, that's what they had covered by copyright.
Yes, that's what they deposited with the U.S. Copyright Office. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that didn't, to me, and I haven't seen the music, I haven't heard it, it didn't contain a lot of those other elements. And to me, that I thought that was going to be an insurmountable obstacle to the Gaye family to overcome.
Because technically the jury wasn't supposed to hear anything but sort of see that the actual written notes on a page.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that they had someone come in. The Gaye estate was allowed to bring someone in to play what was on
that
the sheet music.
Down
the stripped
sheet
down
music.
Version.
Yeah.
But the jury still found that there were similar elements there, which to me was kind of astonishing, to be frank with you.
Let's hear them back to back. I mean, we've heard this in the last week, but one more time. Here's the cowbell and bass line, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams' blurred lines may have played a role in the mind of the jury. Take a listen.
Everybody get up.
Okay, there's Blurred Lines, huge hit in the summer of 2013. We read in the court reporting here, what, Pharrell made something like $7 million. Robin Thicke made something similar on that. T.I., the artist, was in here for less, but a lot of money. And these were people who celebrated Marvin Gaye. Robin Thicke talked about loving the music of Marvin Gaye. Who doesn't? Just listen to that. Now let's put it up against Marvin Gaye's 1977 song, Got to Give It Up. Cowbells, bass line, here we go. Joanna Demers, you can see why the defense never wants to get in front of a jury, because just listen to those back-to-back, and these are at the very least cousins, at least inspired by. When you hear that, do you hear copyright infringement or just a vibe shared?
Well, there are two issues in my mind. There's the ethical question of whether two artists should have gone into a studio and said, let's make a song that sounds a lot like a very well-respected song by a hero in the music industry, and let's just make sure that it doesn't go too far and it doesn't infringe on the copyright of that song.
And you're saying that's what happened from the court testimony?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this happens every single day in the music industry, not only with pop songs, but with jingles for commercials. Music supervision companies are routinely asked to compose music for film or television that sounds enough alike a pre-existing song, but not too close. This thing happens every single day, and until last week, the lines of demarcation were very clear. Everyone kind of knew how far they could go and at what point the similarity became excessive.
So how could it be that the jury could only have heard like a stripped-down replay of the sheet music and still judge this on the basis of a vibe? If you didn't hear the whole production of each, how would they even know the vibe similarity?
Well, I'm reading accounts of the testimony. I was not actually in the courtroom. I know that the lawyer who represented the Gaye family has been very convincing in past cases in arguing that compositions should be judged on a constellation of factors, as he puts it. Not only a melody, not only lyrics, but similarities having to do with a wide swath of similarities. And I think the jury was convinced on the basis of those similarities. I think it also did not help Robin Thicke, the fact that he was... that he changed his story, that at one point he even tried to put all of the blame on Pharrell, claiming that he was drunk and stoned. you know, when you take on a deceased legend of the music industry and sort of preemptively sue that legend's family saying, don't even comment publicly about similarities between my work and your dead father's work, that was a PR mistake on the part of Thicke.
John, you can see why you don't want to get into court with these deals.
No.
What usually happens when there's people get close like this?
Usually when you get close, and sometimes it'll come down to the day of trial, usually there's a settlement. And the reason is because you never know. Any good trial lawyer will tell you, you never know what a jury's going to do. Mm-hmm. And that's why many times, if you depending on the facts that you have to possibly consider settlement. It's my understanding that Thicke and Farrell's team did make an offer to settle the case to the Gay family, which they refused. And I'm sure as the case went on, they possibly felt even stronger. I wasn't there as well. I wish I could have been there.
There was a lot on the line. They actually sued the Gay family preemptively, and then there's this countersuit. Don't musicians go even before you get into legal realm and say, hey, maybe we're close to your song. Here's a money offering so we don't get into the courts?
Well, they certainly will from now on. I really think that that's exactly what you're going to see. I think that labels are going to bring on people like Joanna to advise them as if they hear something close so that they can advise their artists and their songwriters that, look, this might be close enough that you may need to get permission.
But there are so many songs these days that sound like an homage or inspired by songs from the past. I think about Bruno Mars and a whole lot of more composers, musicians, performers out there. This could get messy in a hurry. John Kellogg with me here in the studio from the Berklee College of Music. Joanna Demers from University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music, a forensic musicologist there. We're talking this hour about the blurred lines, got to give it up, copyright verdict. Listeners, you can join us. Did the jury get it right? Did Farrell and Robin Thicke rip off Marvin Gaye? Or is this homage? Is this evolution? Is this the way music is made? Musicians, do you feel a big freeze coming on? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. We'll hear a lot more music pairings. See what you think. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the blurred lines, got to give it up, copyright verdict, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams versus Marvin Gaye's children, a $7-plus million judgment, and its impact going forward on how music is made. Do people borrow from the past? You better believe they do. Uptown Funk, Mark Ronson, Bruno Mars behind us here. All kinds of 70s sound there. Is that a ripoff? Is that homage? Is that respect to the past? Right there, you can join us this hour. Do you think the jury got it right in this case? Is this okay? Is this too much? And if one song can't sound sort of like another, will we get fresh music or will we get nothing? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Joanna Demers is with us, forensic musicologist from the University of Southern California's Thornton School of Music. John Kellogg is here, entertainment lawyer at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. You can join us as well, 800-423-TALK. Our listeners have a lot to say about this. Andrew in Nashville, Music City. Andrew, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, so first of all, I don't agree with the jury's decision. I mean, copying in music to an extent when it's not blatant happens all the time. It's a perfectly normal thing. That goes back hundreds of years when you're looking at your classical composers, your romantic composers, and it used to be viewed as a form of flattery. My pithy comment on this has been that Paul McCartney could sue everyone who's made music in the last 40 years yeah. if the precedent set by this jury's decision were to stand.
But you heard Marvin Gaye's daughter there, Andrew, saying, come on, have some respect for the man. He came up with a sound and you can't just take it.
I agree with that. But actually, Tom, the thing that frustrates me about the jury's decision and with copyright law in general, what makes it difficult is it's not like Marvin Gaye's commercial prospects have been hurt by the success of this song. Marvin Gaye wasn't suddenly selling less albums because Blurred Lines came out. So really what she's saying is it feels like they did absolutely copy that sound and that vibe. I don't disagree with that, but I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with that. It's not like Marvin Gaye didn't already get to make money from Marvin Gaye's music.
Of course, he'd have to have a heck of a comeback to make $7.4 million in one go. But I take your point, Andrew. There's a lot of this out there. The question about whether or not there's more borrowing today than in the past. Here's another pair that got a big attention. We'll start with Stay With Me, Sam Smith.
Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need.
Well, nice song, nice sound. But Sam Smith settled with Tom Petty in October with a similar chord progression in Stay With Me from his Won't Back Down. Joanna Demers in L.A., you are our forensic musicologist. Would you advise Sam Smith to settle with Tom Petty on that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What's surprising is that Sam Smith's people did not alert him or alert each other to the similarity before the track was released. And the way that it was covered in the media, it was a very amicable settlement. Sam Smith... not only asserted that he meant absolutely no plagiarism or theft, but that he had the utmost respect for Tom Petty, and I think Tom Petty's representatives, just contacted Smith's representatives ahead of time and said, there is a substantial similarity here, what do you want to do about it? And I think that's as far as it got.
But I mean, John, maybe I'm just a layman here, but maybe all music just sounds, maybe there's a lot of songs that sound the same. I mean, to me, I get it. I hear that something similar going on, but they're two different songs to me. Would you have said pay up for that?
And considering what we're going through right now, yes. And I think that at that time, it just settled maybe a month or so ago.
Yes.
And I think that their attorneys for Sam Smith had an idea of how the Gaye case was going. I wasn't there, but I'm sure that they kept track of it.
Okay.
And they could have said,
so
if this case comes down the way we don't think it should come down, I think it might be best to settle this case. The thing about copyright cases is that you have to prove two elements, access and substantial similarity.
Access meaning you've heard
the music before, and I'm sure.
Of course,
a young
songs,
Sam Smith might have said, I've never heard of Tom Petty in my life.
Well,
but in spite of that, I mean, he's heard of Tom Petty, but I never heard that song by Tom Petty.
Yeah.
But they advised him that, look, Sam, if you go to trial on this, you never know how a jury's going to come out. You don't want to run the risk. It's going to cost you less to settle this case than to proceed and accrue attorney's fees and possibly a big judgment at the end.
Of course, so you want younger and younger musicians so they can plausibly argue that they've never heard. I mean, who hadn't heard that Tom Petty song somewhere along the way? I mean, there's such a history of this. It goes way back. George Harrison notched his first solo number on the charts with his 1970s hit, My Sweet Lord. But that hit sounded a little too familiar to the 1958 single, He's So Fine by the Chiffons. Harrison tried to settle out of court. A judge found him guilty. This was a big deal back in the day of subconscious plagiarism. Quoting the judge there, he had to pay a judgment over $500,000. That was big, too. First, George Harrison, his first hit, My Sweet Lord. Still a nice sound. There was a sound when you could not have the radio on and not hear that song. But in 1958, it was a different song. He's So Fine from the Chiffons.
I don't know how I'm gonna do it, but I'm gonna make a mind. He's the envy of all the girls. It's just a matter of time. He's a soft-spoken guy.
Joanna, okay, how do you avoid this? I mean, the Beatles paid a lot of attention to a lot of music. We all know that. Subconscious plagiarism is grounds for successful copyright prosecution. Who can avoid that?
This is a very curious case. All of the accounts that I've read about it seem to agree that George Harrison was probably telling the truth, in the sense that, you know, he might have heard back in the early 60s the Chiffon song, but that was not what was going on in his head when he literally sat down in the studio and started to jam.
Yeah, he wasn't spinning old 45s in the Apple studio or wherever they were.
Yeah, no, it wasn't like that. He, from the accounts that I've read, was not actually musically literate in the sense that he did not sit down and write the notation. He just started to jam. And Billy Preston, who co-wrote the song with him, was the person who actually notated it. This was a point in Harrison's career where he was really interested in connecting music with his spiritual practice.
Yeah.
This was almost a religious expression for him, and I really doubt that in the midst of all of that, he was also thinking, gee, I want to steal this Chiffon song. That said, well, I don't know if John wants to come in.
Yes. I mean, that certainly is part of it. And this gets to the issue of access. Of course, he admitted that he probably heard that song. He's so fine, and he didn't.
Everybody
really,
heard
he
it was, at some
yes,
point.
He wasn't copying then. That. But it's important to note that access, once again, is very, very important in the Michael Bolton case. In 1995 or so, that was one of the issues. Michael Bolton said he never heard the song "Love Is a Wonderful Thing."
We've got that pairing. "Love Is a Wonderful Thing." This was a big Bolton deal, and after he lost a case over this, it really kind of shut him down for a while. 1991, "Love Is a Wonderful Thing."
Love is a wonderful thing. Pick a smile.
Great sound, but what about the Isley Brothers' 1966 single of the same name?
Love is a wonderful thing. I said love.
Love is a wonderful thing.
I said love.
Love is a wonderful thing. Love is a wonderful thing.
I said love.
Love makes the world go round.
I love.
Love is a beautiful sound.
Love is a wonderful thing.
Love is a wonderful thing.
John Kellogg, what was he thinking? Same name.
Well, yeah, Michael Bolton basically based his case on access. He basically said that I'd never heard this song before. I'd never heard the Isley Brothers. But then, and this is the reason why when you go into this kind of case, and it happened in the Blurred Lines case,
yes,
the infringer is on trial.
Yeah.
And, of course, Robin Thicke didn't look good from his testimony.
I mean, he brought in his own keyboard, and he played music from U2 and the Beatles and Michael Jackson, tried to say to the jury, look, there's all kinds of similarities, but it's not wrong.
That's true, but he also testified that I was high on drugs, I wasn't there, and
Pharrell
I still
it.
Got credit. Right, Pharrell did it, and I still got credit, so I'm sure the Gay family and everyone else thought, well, wait a minute, if you're getting credit, you didn't even write anything, then why not credit?
At least.
That could have been part of it. Yes, that could have been it.
Let's go to Detroit. Adrian, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am calling from Motown.
Hey.
I
might get sued if I say hey.
Yeah, you might get sued. But I'm saying I hear a lot of songs that are sampled, and I believe the case with Robin Thicke, if he had gone to Marvin Gaye's daughter and say, you know what, I love your dad, if I would give your percentage if you let us use your dad's music. And I think she perhaps would have said, I feel respected and validated, and yes, go on and do it, and we'll give you 1% of billions that we're making. And then and the music industry is a billion-dollar industry. Don't you think they can hire someone that's their job to say, you know what, that sounds very close to this. Let me just check before you release that song and be sued for millions, right?
Adrian,
you take that chance.
We've got it. You're the voice of Motown standing up for the old school original there, and I hear that. Of course, the price can be very high. Michael Bolton's case, it was over $5 million. The court awarded to the Isley Brothers and gave the brothers 28% of future royalties from Bolton's album. Kind of shut Bolton down for a long time. Let's put it to a musician. Bonnie McKee joins us right now from Los Angeles, singer, songwriter. She's co-written 8 number one singles, working with artists like Katy Perry, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, Keisha, Kelly Clarkson, right on down. Bonnie, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's the chatter? What's the talk in your neck of the woods, Bonnie? Is there already a chilling effect from this Blurred Lines verdict?
Yes, absolutely. It's troubling, for sure. I mean, are there similarities? Of course. But does it cross the line between homage and plagiarism? I don't think it does. I think it's a stretch. And it's hard to say with something like this because it's a genre. You know, it's a groove. And usually, traditionally, that's not something that you can copyright. You know, there are people that have the job, like you were talking about, where they say, oh, let me take a look at this and see if it's too similar. And they're called musicologists, and there's a science to it. And I don't think that we've had this problem before where it comes down to a groove, to a bass line and a drum pattern, because there are only so many in the world. You know, at this point in history, there's really not a lot that hasn't been done.
Bonnie, when you're co-writing with Kesha or Carly Rae Jepsen or Ellie Goulding, whoever it may be, are you, as apparently Robin and Pharrell were, are you consciously saying, you know, oh, let's think about this or that song from the past and what we might do with that groove or that sound?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, you come into the studio to write a song, and sometimes you pull something out of thin air, and sometimes you get stuck and you go, you know what, let's go on YouTube and watch some videos and get inspired and listen to some old things. Like, what's a big chorus that we love? And then we might take the cadence from it, but then change the notes. Or you might just take a vibe from something. I mean, vibe is a big word that's thrown around in the studio. And I don't know if you can really copyright vibe.
So, Joanna, how is this going to work if everybody is essentially referencing something in the past? I mean, Beethoven was referencing Bach. Where does this verdict leave the creative conversation?
Well, what we are seeing right now in terms of copyright for compositions is that it is starting to be enforced in a manner very similar to the copyright for sound recordings. There was a few years ago a very important legal decision that gave us what we currently have in terms of sampling law, which is that any sound, no matter the contents of the sound, the duration of it, is eligible for copyright protection. For a while, the music industry was operating under two kind of parallel paradigms, where compositions had a lot more flexibility. Artists were freer to borrow without getting sued. Those days are over.
So if you go back to the Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, back in that day, De La Soul, they had a lot more sampling. They could sort of do collages of other people's work, and it was okay.
Well, it wasn't okay. There were lawsuits back then, and most of them settled out of court until the early 90s, when there were a few very high-profile suits that also settled out of court, oddly enough, but not before they got a lot of press attention and a lot of they generated a lot of fear on the part of music industry executives who said, okay, from now on, if an artist samples, he or she has to get a license ahead of time. What I see happening in the paradigm of copyright for composition is more of the same now, where artists are going to have to license a substantial similarity. If they go in the studio and say, okay, we want the vibe for a particular song, they're going to have people on the publishing end saying, well, did you license that? And unfortunately, often the onus, the financial onus for that licensing falls on the artist, him or herself.
Bonnie, does it feel like you're going to have not just Katy Perry or, Tayo Cruz to work with here, but an attorney all the time?
I mean, it's kind of sounding that way. It's definitely striking fear into the hearts of songwriters. I hope that it is challenged because, you know, even the publishers and the record labels, when they send out who's looking lists of artists that are looking for songs, they'll say, you know, we're looking for something that's like Since You've Been Gone meets Don't Stop Believing Journey. And so then we go, okay, cool. And you take that and you run with it. And, you know, that's how they reference what they're looking for an artist. And if you take that out of the equation, it's kind of hard to explain, like, what you're even looking for if you can't reference other songs.
Bonnie McKee, Stand By in L.A., it's so great to have you. Bonnie McKee co-wrote Teenage Dream and Roar and Part of Me with Katy Perry and more. Dynamite, Tayo Cruz, Hold It Against Me, Britney Spears. What about now, after this ruling on Blurred Lines? Behind us here, Shake Your Rump, Beastie Boys, all kinds of sampling and references there. Couldn't do that today. What changes now? John Kellogg, Joanna Demers, Bonnie McKee, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
If the truth makes love last longer, why do lies make my love stronger?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking about the Blurred Lines, Got to Give It Up, copyright verdict, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams versus Marvin Gaye's children, a $7 million plus judgment, and its impact going forward on how music is made. Ain't that peculiar from Marvin Gaye behind us right here? There was a threat in the midst of all this that in the Gaye family that they would go after Pharrell's Happy, saying that it took off of Ain't That Peculiar. That didn't happen, but a big verdict for them. Hey, it was a big payday in the first place for Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams, but it's a lot smaller now after a verdict of that size. John Kellogg is with us, entertainment lawyer for over 30 years from the Berklee College of Music, author of Take Care of Your Music Business. Joanna Demers is with us from L.A., forensic musicologist at the Thornton School of Music at USC. Bonnie McKee is with us, co-writer of many big, big hits with many big, big stars. Looking at what this may mean for music going forward, listeners, you can join us. Are you now thinking about every new song that comes out asking, doesn't that sound sort of like this or that? Didn't Beethoven borrow from Bach, build on him? Isn't that how music is made? Or in our age of sampling, when you can grab anybody's beat, melody, lyric in a second, do we need harder lines? Not blurred. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Suzanne in Williamsburg, Virginia. You're on the air, Suzanne. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I can't help but think about the role that envy plays in all of this lawsuit back and forth. If Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke had done something that was not smashingly wonderful, not the talk of the town for
not $17 million,
exactly.
Successful in a
and,
jiffy.
You know, they took a great groove, admittedly, and they turned it into something bright and new, and people were wild about it. If it had been an obscure little hit, would this envy be pouring out like this?
Let me hold that question, Suzanne, and get one more call, and we'll pick it up. Envy is here in my left hand and in my right. Angela in New Orleans, you're on.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that a guy who called in just a little bit ago, Andrew, I think was his name, and he said, oh, gosh, you know, it's not like Marvin Gaye didn't also benefit from the song. What's it matter if Robin Thicke and Pharrell did what, you know, whatever they did, it is arguably borrowing and not giving credit to the artist. I say, well, that's akin to breaking into someone's home and taking something, and well, they had plenty, so it's okay that I stole a little bit from them because they're still doing okay.
Yeah.
My biggest point is, if you're an artist and you're borrowing, and you know that you're borrowing, and I understand the terms vibe and feeling, just give credit. It's flat-out plagiarism. I think we all can agree with that. Even, I think it's Bonnie who just called in, who's the songwriter for Katy Perry. She does great work. She's done a lot of number one hits. Not my favorite music, but no one can argue she's a great songwriter. If you borrow, give credit to the artist. It's
okay. We got the dignity on that side for the artist. Bonnie, fairness, we called you. You're hard to track down, but we're lucky to have you, and I appreciate you being here, Bonnie McKee. Here you are. You're the composer here, so you listen. I mean, here's, you know, envy is the issue here. Would you be envious if somebody 4 years from now comes along and puts something out that sounds very much like one of your big hits with Katy Perry or somebody else? Or, and what about your dignity, Bonnie, down the road?
Well, you know, there's already been cases in my career where I've heard things on the radio and been like, you know, I appreciate the homage. Like, I can hear that they've been influenced by my work, and I'm flattered by it, but it's never been anything enough where I feel like I could take it to court. And I just, again, bringing back the word vibe, I think it's really unfair to say that you can legally protect a vibe. Because it also comes down to genre. Like, you can't really copyright a genre. Like, when you talk about, like, classic rock and roll songs, they'll all have the same blues riff and even the same melodies. But that's just the genre. That's just how it works. So down the line, would I do something about it? I mean, it depends. Again, it comes down to musicology again, where it's like, it's a science. It used to be, traditionally, the law was based on melody, lyric, and cadence. I don't think that groove was a problem before, so this is kind of a new development.
Joanna, take us into the legal detail here. If the jury was instructed that they could only decide on the basis of the sheet music, how do we jump from that to the interpretation that this is an expansion of copyright law to cover groove and vibe?
Well, the gay family lawyer argued that there were substantial similarities between things like signature phrases, vocal hooks, backup hooks, keyboard parts, and it would be one thing if the prosecution instructed the jury to pay attention only to melody and lyrics. What the defense ended up doing is exploding the definition of melody and lyrics and saying, it's not enough just to show a one-to-one correspondence between the gay vocal line and the Williams and Thick vocal line. They basically were able to show intermittent and occasional similarities, but show enough similarities to say this was more than just copying a genre or referencing a vibe. I don't agree with the decision, by the way, but I'm pretty sure that the argument was made to the jury that if they're going to be very strict in considering melody and lyrics, they have to consider all of these different facets. Again, my personal interpretation is that what they really ended up doing as a jury was treating the two recordings and treating substantial similarities between the two recordings. That's not, of course, what they were supposed to do, but that's what they ended up doing.
John Kellogg, do you think this will stand up on appeal if they've really exploded melody and lyrics to include, vibe, genre? Can that stand?
Well, it's going to depend on what the appeals court decides. Of course, the appeals court has to determine if there's errors in the trial that affected the decision in the case. Mm-hmm. If the judge gave an instruction to the jury that, yes, you can consider the vibe, I'm sure the judge didn't do that, but that could possibly be considered an error because the case law prior to this is clear that that is something that you can't do and it can't be considered as being protected by copyright.
Let's hear a little more precedent here. Go way back, Beach Boys, 1963, Surfin' USA.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be surfing like California. You see them wearing their baggies, Huarache sandals too, a bushy, bushy blonde hairdo.
Okay, we all know that one, but it was a little too close to Chuck Berry's 1958 Sweet Little 16.
They're really rocking in Boston and Pittsburgh, PA, deep in the heart of Texas and round the Frisco Bay.
Can't get much closer than that. Forensic musicologist Joanna Demers, they were sued, and Berry was given a co-writing credit, a share of the royalties. But that's more like melody, and not lyric, but melody right in your face.
Not only melody. I mean, the lyrics, the best part of both songs are basically a list of locations, right? So the Beach Boys are listing the best surf sites in Southern California, and Berry is talking about the best places in the country to to rock and roll, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
On a rhetorical level, the lyrics are quite similar, and that for me was the slam dunk aspect of the case.
Boy, never mind just hearing that music back to back, and you get the case. Bill in New Haven, Connecticut. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is an odious case of money spoils all. Okay. How many bluegrass musicians are getting in fights over this kind of stuff when? Really, I mean, if you've been in bluegrass, you know how derivative and beautiful and homage-oriented it is, right?
Yes, I mean, it just goes on and on. It all kind of flows together, and that's okay.
Right, and, you know, you can play Soldier's Joy and whatever. I mean, that's an old tune. So I think it's disgusting, and it's money. But on the other hand, let's look at the good side of this, which is that maybe what will happen is everybody is going to start thinking about old music free copyright. I mean, if you're writing a song and you say, this sheet music from 1877, that is a cool tune, right? This Beethoven lick, this Mahler lick, you know, Viotti, whatever. I mean, you can find all this stuff if you go back far enough. So why don't you just come right out and say, hey, I wasn't listening to this. I was listening to Viotti.
Bill, I love that.
Get
right out of copyright zone. Bonnie McKee, you're going to be taking your licks off Mahler soon as a way to avoid this?
Works in public domain.
Yes, public domain.
You know, it's funny you say that because a lot of times, you know, people in the pop world anyway, we will reference, like, nursery rhymes.
Yes.
Because it's familiar.
Yeah.
And everyone feels like they can sing along with it and they know what's going to happen. They can predict where it's going to go, but no one's going to get sued.
And that's in the public domain. Grant in Springfield, Illinois. Grant, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was lucky enough back in the 70s to see Pete Seeger and Arlo on stage together. And Pete was doing an homage to Woody Guthrie. And a lot of his songs, of course, were labor-oriented, and Pete accused him of borrowing melodies from other songs, and Woody replied, that's just the folk process.
Yeah.
But this was during the Dust Bowl when lawyers were probably paid in a chicken dinner.
Well, but there's something in that, John. I mean, that's just the folk process. Isn't that just the pop music process in so many ways? I hear song after song after song these days that sounds an awful lot like what I've heard before. It still is enough distinctive about it that I don't feel I'm listening to a ditto.
Right. Well, that's what Bonnie said, and she's absolutely right. You can't copyright a genre. It depends on what's copyrightable material. Common drum beats, common chord changes aren't copyrightable. For instance, the upbeat chick that you hear in a reggae song. You can't copyright that.
But you've got this DJ Mustard complaint right now with Fancy. You know, they're talking about his Iggy Azalea's Fancy, and DJ Mustard saying, no, that's my beat you got going on under there. I mean, people still grumble about these things.
Yes.
But if you can't borrow, it seems to me, I mean, Bonnie, maybe the other one to speak to this, but that we live in a time when there's so much sharing and giving and sampling that may be less original sound than at other times in musical composition, but a kind of festival of sharing and flowing between compositions, Bonnie.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think in this kind of playlist generation, we're getting all kinds of genres mashed together. So it's hard to kind of pick and choose what's I think everyone is influenced by what they grew up listening to. And like I said, these days, there's really nothing that hasn't been done. So any song that you hear on the radio, you can compare to something else. But it comes down to melody, lyric, and cadence. That's what makes up a song, isn't it? If you cover a song and you want to sit down on an acoustic guitar and play a song, that's the part that you keep. You don't keep the drum beat, you know? That's how you cover a song. That's what makes up the bones of a song.
But stretch that all the way to copywriting a vibe or genre, and it may be tough to move. We're talking about the blurred lines, got to give it up, jury verdict. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Anya in Ellington, Connecticut. Anya, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My issue with this decision is really the fact that it's really going to deter new and upcoming artists from wanting to sample music from their predecessors. You know, I'm only 25 years old, and to be honest, I probably wouldn't have heard the Beatles or Marvin Gaye and certain older artists had it not been sampled in new and upcoming music. So I think what this decision is going to do is really widen this generation gap of listeners, I mean, from the past, present, and the future. And I think that's going to be an issue with music up and coming. You know, you want new music to be heard by everybody.
And if it's a reference to the past, it helps you understand the cultural history. And yet there's Marvin Gaye's family, part of that cultural history, and they just want a little cash for that. Bonnie, what about the possibility that this will push composers onto new terrain, that we'll get more original music if the sort of hot breath of copyright law is a little bit hotter on your neck?
Yeah, I think it's possible that people may stretch themselves a little bit more, but there's the thing about writing a hit is that feeling familiar is important, you know. And I tell a lot of up and coming songwriters, if they play me something and it's just a little too weird and it's something that like I haven't really heard before and I can't really predict where it's going to go, it's not as catchy. It's not something that, you know, as many people are going to react to. So there's a familiarity about pop music that helps build hits.
Joanna Demers, you're going to have a long line at your forensic musicologist door these days with people wanting your sort of legal sign-off to protect them from suit?
Well, yeah, I mean, that the business is always there for me and other folks. But, yeah, you know, keep in mind that the music industry has so much to gain from rendering the past into a commodity. I mean, artists of the nature of Marvin Gaye and people from, you know, the golden age of the 60s and 70s and 80s, their catalogs are worth so much money. And I think a lot of people inside the music industry are looking on that as a cash cow worth protecting for the conceivable future. So, yes. I anticipate that business will continue.
John, do you think it's going to change the business more, the cash flow behind the scenes, or might it actually change the sound of the music we hear in the pop music world?
Well, yeah, I hope so. Hopefully we'll have more original music. I think back to Marvin Gaye and the great songwriters that were around at that time, particularly the R&B genre.
Yeah.
Smokey Robinson and Stevie Wonder. They had completely different sounds every two or three years, and it was all original.
Yes.
You couldn't relate it to anything else that had been done before. So I think maybe this generation possibly get back to that and really be as original as possible. However, I'm sure they're going to still borrow from the past, but if they do, they're going to have to make sure that they get their samples clear.
It would be a pretty terrific upside if we could get all new music as compelling as that music was in the day.
Absolutely.
If that's what we still want. People like a lot of those references to the familiar. Bonnie McKee, you make it real for us. Bonnie, singer-songwriter, huge success. We wish you more of it, Bonnie. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Joanna Demers in Los Angeles. Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And John Kellogg, entertainment lawyer for a long time out of the Berklee College of Music. Great to have you with us today, John.
My pleasure.
Mr. Marvin Gaye, we'll go out with just a little more of you, sir, the winner in this jury verdict. We'll see where it all goes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.